Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
The overall concept is you have a base. It's the yogurt, the mayonnaise, all that. You have the onion powder, the garlic, and then you have salt and pepper.
Add some herbs, and you got ranch dressing. Chef Dean Workerman of Cardinal Spirits calls it the Midwest mother sauce. He also whips up a chimichurri. We ask Sycamore Land Trust to introduce us to some invasive species. From Harvest Today, the controversy swirling over the world's largest meat company, and some people who own land along the proposed route of the Keystone XL pipeline say their soil is too fragile for that kind of construction. Mr. Mark Gilla, back on the show.
First, catching up on what happened earlier this month, Annie. The Natural Resources Defense Council, an environmental advocacy group, released a report on food waste in the U.S. You've likely heard this figure before. Americans toss out up to 40% of our food. The report also estimates one-fifth of all agricultural water, fertilizer, and cropland produces food that ends up in the landfill. But Joanne Birkenkamp, senior advocate with the NRDC, says consumer awareness has improved thanks to tight wallets.
The average family spends between $1,500 and $1,800 a year on food that we don't eat. That's a lot of money.
Birkenkamp says a combination of policy, business leadership, and consumer education has helped curb food waste since the NRDC's previous report in 2012. For years, online shopping has cut into the margins of brick-and-mortar retail, but it's yet to make a dent in grocery stores. A new Gallup survey shows few Americans are changing their grocery shopping habits, even as food delivery services keep popping up. Gallup found less than 5% of Americans buy groceries online weekly, versus 83% who go to a physical grocery store at least once a week. Logistics and distribution of perishable food are the biggest hurdles when it comes to grocery delivery. The massive online retailer Amazon this summer promised to shake up the market with its proposed purchase of Whole Foods Market, giving the company access to higher-end brands and products from more local farms and ranches. And a supermarket co-op chain in Switzerland is now selling burgers made from mealworms, marking the first time insects have been legally sold as people food in Europe. The country's food safety laws were changed in May to allow human food made from crickets, mealworms, or grasshoppers. All three insects have been used for animal feed, but they were not allowed for humans until health regulators could hammer out strict rules for raising and preparing them. The mealworm burgers from Swiss company Acento are mixed with rice, celery, leeks, and a little kick of hot pepper. A study from the UN Food and Agriculture Organization in 2013 said insects could provide a sustainable source of protein and a tool to stabilize food security amid a growing crisis to feed the world's population. On the website right now, a pair of articles from NPR's Dan Charles about how Walmart might influence farmers to use less fertilizer. Those stories are at eartheats.org.
Along with recipes and interviews and plenty of other food and farm stories. All right, Mark, thanks.
You're welcome.
TransCanada, the company behind the Keystone XL oil pipeline in Nebraska, is looking to finalize its route for the project. Landowners and environmental groups wanted it out of the sand hills, a region with sandy soil that's quick to erode and hard to restore. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach traveled along the proposed route and takes a look at what it would mean for the land.
The sandhills are ancient, windblown sand dunes, now mostly covered by grassland used for grazing cattle. Nebraska lawmakers pushed TransCanada to move Keystone XL to avoid the sandhills. But Art Tandrup, who owns land along the current path, says the company didn't go far enough. I went to Tandrup's corn and soybean farm near Neely in north-central Nebraska to find out why.
You see the fence post straight ahead of us there. And it's in a ridge of dirt here, which has become a drift.
Tandarat plants ryegrass as a cover crop just to keep roots in the soil year-round. Because if he doesn't, well, that's what he wanted to show me.
And there's probably only 2 foot of this fence post sticking out of the ground.
So this fence post should be like 5 feet tall, but it's only a couple feet tall.
This is a sand drift, you know, it drifts out here like snow.
Many landowners on the pipeline route have this same concern, that their soil is too delicate for the disruption that comes with building a pipeline. If TransCanada comes through this farm, the company will bulldoze the thin topsoil and dig a 7-foot trench to bury its pipes. That leaves the soil Tandarap works so hard to hold down exposed to the wind. Even after it's put back in place, he says crops planted there will struggle. TransCanada moved the pipeline out of the sandhills based on a map made for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. But as far as Tandarap is concerned, his farm is in the sandhills too.
I call it the Eastern Sandhills. To me, you know, you got the same soils. The soil is so sandy that you have to protect it from erosion. You have to protect it from blowouts.
James Swinehart created his own map in the Atlas of the Sandhills. Swinehart was a geologist with the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He's now retired. The boundaries can get fuzzy, he says, but his map confirms Art Tandarap's farm is not in the sandhills, and neither is the pipeline.
The definition of the sandhills, to me, has to have a component, has to be a wind-blown deposit.
But how much does that matter that it's wind-blown sand? Mark Kozilla, a retired soil scientist from UNL, says there's not much difference between soil in the sandhills and sandy soil nearby.
A sandy soil, whether it be in the sandhills or outside the sandhills, have very similar properties if they were in close proximity, and they would be treated the same, should be treated the same in management.
By contrast, TransCanada built its first Keystone pipeline in eastern Nebraska, where the soil is much more resilient. Kozilla says it typically is more fertile and holds more water than Art Tandarap's sandy soil. One alternative for TransCanada is to put Keystone XL there, in eastern Nebraska, in those heavier soils. But company spokesman Matthew John says going that route would mean more miles of pipe, which would be more expensive and would also put more land in the pipeline's path.
It's not just one part of the pipeline moving from here to there. That impacts your route all the way up. If there are variations that need to be made north as well, it's going to disturb more people, more land, and more water crossing.
We're actually standing right where the trench would be.
Farmer Art Tandarap says many of his neighbors have signed on with TransCanada, but he's one of 20 or so landowners holding out in his county. It's not just because of erosion he won't sign on. He worries that an oil spill could spoil his water supply. And he'd like to see the U.S. push beyond fossil fuels.
You know, we're saddling up the horse and buggy here again when we should be looking forward to clean renewable energies.
But when it comes down to it, Tandarap says the pipeline would run just about 600 feet from his house. And regardless of whether the map calls it the Sandhills, that hits awfully close to home. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
As the saying goes, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. That's especially true when we're talking about invasives, plants that don't belong in an ecosystem and can quickly grow and crowd out native varieties. Prevention sometimes involves hand-pulling these nasty plants, and sometimes it involves spraying herbicide. I visited the Sycamore Land Trust to find out how they deal with invasives. John Lawrence is suited up with a jetpack of triclopyr, an herbicide specific to broad-leaved plants. In his hand is a sprayer wand that allows him to direct the blue liquid to the exact spot he wants to kill. He says this is probably his favorite part of the job.
I really do feel that there's a meditative quality to coming out here and doing this. Okay, concentrating on what's in front of you and listening to the sounds of the birds and crickets around us while we're doing a little spritz and a spritz.
Lawrence is the assistant director of Sycamore Land Trust, a nonprofit organization that conserves land by acquisition or by holding conservation easements. He and I are just steps away from the Sycamore headquarters. Today's project is to try to beat back one particular invasive from moving from their front lawn into the adjacent woods.
right here as we're standing, we've got a whole bunch. This is kind of a carpet of this real thick, kind of shiny leaved plant. A lot of people know that as periwinkle or vinca.
It's everywhere. Are we really going to get all of this?
Well, we'll get what we can. This has been a little bit of a project now and again to try and beat this back a little bit.
Tell me why we don't like it. I mean, why is this worse than the other stuff here?
Right. Well, because it is forming a carpet, and in doing so is excluding all the nice native plants that belong here and that interact with all the insects and birds and other wildlife to create a healthy food web and healthy ecosystem. And with a lot of these bushes, like Asian bush honeysuckle, it greens up earlier and stays green later than some of the natives, so it's shading things out. Just structurally, it's pushing them out. Some actually excrete chemicals that are allopathic. They harm the plants nearby, so they're using chemical warfare.
And which is, you're using chemical warfare.
And so sometimes we have to use chemical warfare too.
It'll probably take 2 or 3 more applications over the next year to eradicate the vinca entirely.
I'm teaching a course now, and we had a unit on invasive plants, so just looking at this list.
Heath Clay is a distinguished professor of biology at Indiana University. He says the list of invasives around Indiana is just growing.
Japanese knotweed is a big issue in many areas. Canadian thistle.
New invasive plants in the Midwest. New?
Yeah, they're constantly coming in. Giant hogweed, if you touch it, you get a nasty rash like poison ivy that lasts for weeks. Oh, Bradford pear is another bad invasive. We've planted it all over the city streets in Bloomington, thinking it was a good street tree, and now it's popping up everywhere, and it's a real pest. So the cat is out of the bag already. Even though they won't plant anymore, it's not going to go away because it's been given such a boost by planting so many trees around. The seeds are everywhere.
He points to the garden and landscaping trade as the way many invasive plants were introduced. He says the plants were undoubtedly favored because they were vigorous and adapted to a wide range of conditions.
And we see many invasive species for sale in nurseries. And sometimes they're unaware, or other times, you know, it's the profit motive overrides any environmental concerns.
As he explains it, when a non-native plant is introduced, either by human action or on their own, those plants leave their insect pests and pathogens behind. The pests may eventually catch up, but in the meantime, humans must intervene. You can pull some of these plants by hand.
And something like garlic mustard, they have garlic mustard pulls. They can pull up thousands, tens of thousands of plants. But that's probably replaced. One plant can produce 10,000 seeds to replace every single one of those plants. So the capacity of these plants to reproduce and generate bigger populations is pretty impressive.
Spritzing the plants with herbicide before they have a chance to set seed gives us a fighting chance. Clay says we'll always have invasive species in our ecosystems. And for his purposes, that can actually be beneficial.
This is highly self-motivated, but if we got rid of all invasives, we'd also get rid of a lot of interesting opportunities for research. For example, the idea that pests and pathogens will eventually begin to colonize and attack the invasive species. This is something we're working on right now with Japanese stiltgrass. These fungal pathogens seem to have made a jump onto the stiltgrass, and we have hopes that maybe it'll help bring it under control. So we're watching that process going on right now. Where are these fungi coming from? Did they get here from the native range, or are they jumping from native species or other invasive species? We don't know, but they're coming from somewhere, and it's an interesting question, I think.
Did he say which side? This side?
John Lawrence organized a volunteer work day at one of Sycamore's newest areas. the Sam Shine Foundation Preserve.
I see red berries. Does that mean that's what that is?
That's the one.
The target today is Asian bush honeysuckle. Volunteers are armed with hedge clippers and spray bottles of herbicides. First, they cut down the bush as close to the ground as possible. Then they spritz on the cut stem.
The red berries, the light-colored stump.
Got it.
Pretty much the giveaway.
Lawrence is suited up with a different kind of jetpack today. He's operating a gas-powered saw to chop down the biggest bushes. He's eyeing a 12-foot-high Asian bush honeysuckle with a multi-stemmed trunk. The eventual goal is to get this area back to what it wants to be, whether that be a swamp or a forest. Lawrence has been doing this sort of work with sycamore for years, and while it feels like fighting a losing battle at times, there are spots that are showing progress.
There's some spots that I've been working on for some years, and they've finally turned the corner, and it's super rewarding to go back where, wow, you know, 5-6 years ago, I was out here with volunteers, and we pulled bags and bags of garlic mustard. Now there's just a handful, and instead there are all these beautiful spring wildflowers there instead, you know, trillium, and cutleaf toothwort, all those pretty things.
This is what land stewardship looks like, he says. They're doing this work with an eye toward the future.
And there's also, I think, kind of a living museum quality, I think, where people can go and see this is what Indiana used to look like. But in this human-altered matrix, there's always going to be a little bit of maintenance work.
And there will always be invasives, but both Lawrence and Clay agree that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Read more at sycamorelandtrust.org. A native plant that makes a delicious tea? Spice bush. There's a very cool article with the history of spice bush tea and a recipe at eartheats.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. This is Earth Eats. It's been a rough few months for the world's largest meat company. Brazil-based JBS is known for rapidly expanding across the globe. The company is so large, if you eat meat, there's a good chance you've eaten their chicken, beef, or pork. But as Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports, a series of scandals has hit the meatpacking giant.
In March, Wesley Batista, the CEO of JBS, jumped on a routine conference call with investors. He starts off listing the company's first quarter financial figures. Then he gets to the juicy stuff.
Moving to our beef business in South America, primarily Brazil, you all know that, you know, we had a problem in March.
That problem was a sting conducted by Brazilian law enforcement in an operation called Carne Fraca, which translates to weak flesh. Federal agents raided some of Brazil's largest meat packers. They accused JBS and other processors of bribing government meat inspectors to turn a blind eye to food safety problems. The company denied any wrongdoing. But countries around the world, including the U.S., responded by closing off imports of Brazilian beef.
We reduced volume, cost went up, and we incurred in a lot of expenses due to these problems.
But that was just the beginning of JBS's year of scandal. Another corruption probe alleges the company received suspect loans from Brazil's federal bank, enabling JBS to expand rapidly worldwide over the last decade. Here's Tatiana Bautzer, a business reporter for Reuters based in Sao Paulo.
So they were expanding because they had kind of unlimited access to funds.
The company's troubles didn't stop there. Yet another probe yielded secret tapes of Brazil's president Michel Temer, allegedly discussing bribery of a former legislator. Those tapes were recorded by the JBS chairman and came to light when he and his brother, the CEO we heard earlier, signed a plea deal with federal prosecutors and agreed to have JBS's holding company pay a $3.2 billion fine. Now, JBS is selling some of its assets, a large Brazilian dairy company, a poultry processor in Europe, and all of its cattle feedlots here in the U.S. Bautzer says it's not surprising, given the huge fine the company has to pay.
But I think they will try to preserve JBS as much as they can in the current size. I don't know whether they'll be able to do that.
Any changes JBS makes will ripple through the global food system. Many American ranchers sell their cattle to feedlots or slaughterhouses owned by JBS's American subsidiary. At least one U.S. rancher group, the Ranchers Cattlemen Action Legal Fund, or RCAF, has called for an investigation of JBS USA.
Here we have a company whose business model includes bribery and other corrupt practices.
Bill Bullard is RCAF's CEO and a former Montana rancher.
And we believe that it's highly possible that this company is deploying that same corrupt business model here in the United States of America.
There's no evidence of that. I talked with a JBS spokesman for this story, but didn't record the conversation. He says JBS's decision to sell the feedlots will allow the company to focus more on slaughtering and processing cattle. And while some ranchers are closely monitoring every twist and turn this story has taken, others definitely are not. Tracy Brunner is a rancher in Ramona, Kansas, and the outgoing president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
Concentration doesn't concern me because I know the beef industry is built on opportunity.
Brunner says it's always concerning to see a meat packer in turmoil. But as long as they're not talking about shutting down slaughter plants, he says he's not too worried about it.
The five major meat packers of 100 years ago are not the five major meat packers of today and likely will not be 50 years from now.
In other words, ranchers are already pretty good at weathering change. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest reporters tell stories from Colorado, Kansas, Missouri, Iowa, and everywhere in between. Find them at harvestpublicmedia.org. So this is the ranch, right?
Yeah, we're going to start with the ranch, and then we'll just make a pretty salad.
Time to cook. We're at Cardinal Spirits today. We've talked about their distillery on the show, but it was great to spend some time in their new kitchen last month with executive chef Dean Workerman. He's making two sauces for us today. Chimichurri is coming up. First, though, this ranch recipe was the product of an accident.
I was making a panna cotta, and I was using creme fraiche instead of whipped cream to lighten it.
But he made a mistake. He overmixed the creme fraiche. Instead of trashing the failed panna cotta, he just kept mixing it to see what would happen.
So the little specks that I was finding in the creme fraiche turned into butter, and then I kept mixing it on the KitchenAid, and that butter separated completely, and this watery, milky liquid came out.
He had achieved buttermilk. These days, it's a byproduct of the house-made butter they whip up in the Cardinal Spirits kitchen. Like any frugal chef, Workerman has found a use for it. Buttermilk, plus Greek yogurt, plus mayonnaise, plus these other ingredients equals ranch dressing.
We're gonna just scoop everything out. The Greek yogurt's very thick, and that's gonna really help make it not a runny dressing. That's kind of the hard part about these creamy dressings is making sure that it's not a vinaigrette. Got mayonnaise, and they're all equal amounts.
Do you make your mayonnaise?
No, absolutely not. Never.
Really?
Absolutely, no. You're not gonna make better mayonnaise than Hellman's, so don't waste your time.
You heard it here first.
Okay, so the liquids are mixed together. All right, so nothing too special about this part. I'm just gonna start dumping stuff in. Okay.
that was the garlic. This is the
red chili flakes, herbs, fresh herbs. Thyme, super important. Dill, super important. And everything else is just for complexity. Now we're dumping a lot of onion powder, a good amount of garlic powder, and dried dill.
Wow, you put that in and suddenly it looks like ranch dressing.
So let's taste this bad boy. Yep, I love it. I'm glad I didn't add all the salt.
He plated up a simple salad of crunchy iceberg lettuce, radishes, lentil sprouts, and some very special herbs and flowers he picked from his garden that morning. An important reminder there to tailor these recipes to your taste, especially when it comes to salt. Workerman takes liberties like that all the time.
I have a general guideline to get started, and then maybe make it 4 or 5 times, and then start trusting your own tastes.
That's how he tweaked Cardinal Spirits chimichurri. It's a very green sauce made with lots of fresh herbs and olive oil. It's traditionally served with grilled meat. He has this memory of a chimichurri from an Argentinian restaurant in Chicago many moons ago. He's still striving to match that flavor. This recipe is how he's making chimichurri these days.
Okay, so we're gonna take 2 parts mint to 1 cilantro. We did parsley for a while. I felt cilantro made things a little bit more exotic. As you're cutting your herbs, it's nice to toss them in olive oil to help with the oxidation. So we're just adding, this is actually a Greek varietal. It's not the most expensive oil we buy, but it's pretty good. We're happy with it.
And that was a lot.
Yeah, just, it's the way I want this to look is to be able to create a dressing, if you will. If it's too thick, it's eating a mint salad. So we want to split it up with some garlic and oil and later acid. That's a wrap. We'll get this in a deli and label it. It'll be a beautiful thing.
It is a beautiful thing. Right before sending it to the customer, he adds the acid. A heaping spoonful of the chimichurri goes on top of some very lightly grilled cubes of New York strip. See the entree and the recipe at eartheats.org. Special thanks this week to Dean Workerman and Erica Sagone of Cardinal Spirits. The everyday crew at Earth Eats is Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, and Daniel Orr. Our executive producer is John Bailey. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. And Needmore Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. And, of course, there's you. Thank you for supporting Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Bye-bye.